The following is Colin Klase's talk, Why We Should Not Focus on UX, from the 2011 Information Architecture Summit.
The 2011 IA Summit podcasts are brought to you by UIE's User Experience Training Library, with scores of online seminars your team can access on demand. Hear the field's top experts on timely topics and the current design challenges you're facing. Get a free UIE virtual seminar at uie.com/IAS11.
Hi, everyone. Welcome. So I'd like to introduce our next speaker, Cohen. He's, I think, the only Belgian here. And I don't know what that means, but he's the only Belgian. This talk focuses on and calls us, I guess, to redefine, when we say the word experience, what experience means. It's based on a fascinating piece of research by a Nobel Prize winner. And I think it's going to change a lot of the ways that we think about the work that we're doing and what that work means. So.
Thank you.
Hi, so welcome, please.
So, voila, my name is Koen. You pronounce that Koen. I'd like to start with a little story. So, I'm Belgian, seem to be the only one. I did see a slide of a screenshot of a website in another presentation today, so that's it. So, basically, I live in Belgium, close to Brussels. It's a little city called Leuven. What's special about Leuven is it has a university, it's a quite old university. And that means that there are a lot of students living in Leuven. And what that means is that there are a lot of cafes in Leuven. What that means is that there are a lot of rumors and sometimes myths going on in Leuven, which I find interesting. One of the myths is, I don't know if you've heard that in the US, I don't know if that exists. Is that if you know Bailey's, which is this creamy kind of sweet liquor, and if you mix that one with Schweppes, that you could actually die. Because you get this kind of chemical reaction, and the two mix, and they become very hard. It becomes like a rock inside your stomach, so you could actually die from that. Which is a very persistent rumor. It's a myth that goes on. So. That's kind of the subject of this presentation today, so not that specific myth, but myths and what makes something spread. So what I tried to find out if that is true. And on YouTube, you can find a lot of videos of people testing that. And I'd like to show one. So, as you can see, it doesn't look very nice, but the conclusion is that you will not actually die when you drink Schweppes and Baileys. It becomes some kind of flaky thing. It's actually because the creamy part of the Baileys, you get a reaction with this acidity in the Schweppes, which kind of makes it split, so you get this flaky thing. You may get some kind of tummy ache, but you won't actually die. But to me, what I find interesting is how come that this myth is so persistent and that it spreads? What makes people want to tell that story to other people? So basically, what makes it spread and also what makes it memorable? And that's actually the subject of the presentation today. It's all about memory, basically. So my name is Koen. I'm actually an information architect or UX designer. I'd like to focus on interaction design, actually. I work in a big agency in Belgium, but we have offices in Paris and Holland, etc. I've been working there for about 4 years, but that's actually not what I'm going to talk about today. I'm not going to share those experiences or anything like that. It's more philosophically, basically, talking about what is UX design and why is it important. I did this presentation once before, so this is just the second time at EuroIA. Some other guys that were there were here as well, like Martin Bellum from The Guardian, Jeff Cottel from The Ladders. I saw that presentation with the Mecano mobile user testing thing, which I didn't get a chance to see then, but I got the chance to see it now. So basically, I have to check the time because it will be tight. I chunked it up in three big blocks. The first block, I'm going to talk about the importance or the unimportance of UX and why I feel that way. Try to give some arguments about that. The second part is a little bit more theoretical, how the human memory works. But I won't use too much Latin. The third part is how we can make something actually memorable. So first, if we check the definition of experience, you can actually look at it in two ways. The first one is actually that you see experience as a feeling of something right here, right now, to go or live through an event as apprehended. Maybe you're feeling a bit cold right now because of the airco. So that's actually what you're experiencing right now, the feeling you have right now. So that's actually experience as something that is volatile. Second definition is something much more persistent. It's experience, as Jared Spool said, something like doing your time, getting knowledge, getting this experience, skills that you learn. So that's something persistent, and it's more the second part that we should focus on. It's a little bit different, but basically, what got all of this thinking for me started was watching a TED video with Daniel Kahneman. I don't know if you're familiar with him. He's a very well-known psychologist. He's one of the founding fathers of behavioral economics. He worked on the endowment effect, the framing, which was also mentioned by Steven Anderson before. And in this talk, he speaks about his experiences while researching happiness and well-being. So it's not directly related to what we do now, but there are a lot of similarities, actually. I'd like to show you just a two-minute fragment of what he was talking about.
Now, I'd like to start with an example of somebody who had a question and answer session after one of my lectures, reported a story, and that was the story. He said he had been listening to a symphony, and it was absolutely glorious music. And at the very end of the recording, there was a dreadful screeching sound. And then he added, really quite emotionally, it ruined the whole experience. But it hadn't. What it had ruined was the memory of the experience. He had had the experience. He had had 20 minutes of glorious music. They counted for nothing because he was left with a memory, the memory was ruined, and the memory was all that he had gotten to keep. What this is telling us, really, is that we might be thinking of ourselves and of other people in terms of two selves. There is an experiencing self who lives in the present and knows the present. It's capable of reliving the past, but basically it has only the present. It's the experiencing self that the doctor approaches, you know, when the doctor asks, does it hurt now when I touch you here? And then there is a remembering self. And the remembering self is the one that keeps score and maintains the story of our life. And it's the one that the doctor approaches in asking the question, how have you been feeling lately? Or how was your trip to Albania? Or something like that. Those are two very different entities, the experiencing self and the remembering self. And getting confused between them is part of the mess about the notion of happiness. Now, the remembering self is a storyteller. And that really starts with a basic response of our memory. It starts immediately. We don't only tell stories when we set out to tell stories. Our memory tells us stories. That is, what we get to keep from our experiences is a story. And let me begin with one example.
So basically, the example he goes on to explain is this kind of medical experiment of two patients undergoing a medical procedure, a colonoscopy. I won't explain that in detail, but basically what happens is they're asked to report their level of pain every 60 seconds. So if you look back at those definitions of experience, it's actually the experience now. So it's the feeling at the moment. We're not talking about long term, it's actually now. So you got patient A and patient B. and you get these peaks. So it's actually pretty obvious. In terms of experience, the colonoscopy was much worse for patient B than it was for patient A because it was much longer. He had more peaks. The highest peaks is the same for both, but basically for patient B it was much worse than for patient A, right? Now, the interesting thing is that if asked later, like we're talking weeks or months later, how they remember the colonoscopy, then the results are totally different. Because for patient A, it seems, he had a much worse memory of the colonoscopy than patient B, which is actually quite remarkable because for the experience, it was much worse for B than for A. Now, the reason for this in this case is that the peak at the end was much worse for patient A than it was for patient B. For patient B, it gradually went down, basically. This is actually quite remarkable because it's a direct conflict between your memory and your experience. And as you said, we tell ourselves stories. And in storytelling, there are three important moments or events, which are significant events happening in the story. It's changes, and it's the endings. The endings are very important, as in the experiment. I also want to make a quick reference to the other presentation by Johanna, who basically talked about changes and how that can be disturbing, with the nice example of Sweden, where they switched from left-hand driving to right-hand side driving. But also in changing the interfaces of Facebook or Twitter, for example, and actually how we remember that. How we remember that actually things changes, and there was this whole fuss about that. The reason for this is that the way we remember things is we tell ourselves stories based on these three elements, significant moments, changes, and endings, which means that we actually don't encode the full time spans. We don't remember time spans. Think of it in terms of if a vacation, if you go to the beach, it's a 1 week vacation, you have these certain memories of the vacation, but if you would then be asked to stay 1 week longer and you do exactly the same things you did the first week, that actually there are no new memories added. And you don't really feel that the 2 week vacation was much more than the 1 week vacation actually because there are no new memories added. Now this is also linked to the concept of the psychological present. Psychological present is something very, very short. It's just 2 to 3 seconds long. Everything that's farther away than those 2 to 3 seconds, basically the very large majority of it we just forget. We always think that we experience things and that we remember everything, but that's actually not true. The psychological present is very short, and some things we do remember, but most things we actually forget. So this, to summarize Daniel Kahneman, we actually don't choose between experiences, we choose between memories of experiences. And I actually want to let that sink in for a moment because this changed the whole way I thought about UX design because it actually has quite a big impact. Because designing great experiences, apparently that's just pointless. Another reference to a previous presentation by Samantha is where she said that she was at an airport and she was waiting in the horizon line, I think it was, and that she would wait for 50 minutes and then she had to switch to another line. And then she said she actually has a camera with her to take pictures of those experiences. Now, if you think about it, that's actually to get a memory of the experience itself. It's not really about the experience, it's how she remembers afterwards that experience. Other impacts, this is just a quote from Jason Fried from 37 Signals. He quotes these one-liners often. With this one, I don't happen to agree, or I happen not to agree. He says, cool is a detail, useful is a quality. That's not necessarily true. Also, other people, like, because a website is easy to use, that doesn't mean that people won't grow tired of it, or people won't switch from it. Because if it's the same, a bit like that vacation, and there are no new memories added, and everything is fine, but then some other website crosses your path, which is more interesting and kind of remarkable, and it gets your attention that you might still switch to that website. Now, creating these great experiences for traffic to get people to come back to your website, you could say that that's not always the most important part because not all websites need recurring traffic. Take, for example, like a concert, where you just have to buy the ticket and then afterwards you don't really have to come back. So you could argue, yes, but that's not always important. But remember that another element that plays is what makes something spread. If you have that music website or that website to buy the ticket, you also want that experience of buying the ticket to be memorable. And then you want them to tell that to the other friends so you get actually more traffic. So that a bit about the different way of thinking about how important is UX design really. So it's actually the memory that actually seems to be more important than the experience itself. Now, a little part about how the memory works. So there are actually different types of memory. Everybody knows like mental time travel, which basically means experiencing past memories. So like you think back of a previous vacation, for example, that's actually you're traveling back in time inside your memory. That's basically long-term memory or explicit memory, as it is called sometimes. But there are also different types of memories, which usually is called implicit memory. And here different things come into play. For example, if you recognize something, memory is also involved. If something feels familiar, it's because you've seen it previously, and it feels familiar because it's inside your memory. Also different effects like recency and priming, which have been mentioned previously. So this is a different type of memory. It's much more short term, and often it's also an unconscious memory. It's not like you're consciously going back in time to see a memory. It's actually the memory playing a different role. Now, again, to give an idea about how extremely short these things are, you have your conscious awareness is only 100 milliseconds. If it's farther than that, it's not actually inside your conscious memory. And as I said before, your psychological present is only 2 to 3 seconds long. Everything that's farther than these 2 to 3 seconds, that's actually considered to be almost long-term memory, if it even gets encoded into your memory, because most things don't. A book tip, if you want to know more about this, is Blink from Malcolm Gladwell. It talks about these types of split-second decisions. He has a lot of funny or fun anecdotes if you're interested in that. Now, I want to do a quick test, actually, to see how this works and how fast the memory works. So I hope you will help me here. So I will ask you a number of questions. This test, what I want to test here is speed. So you have to answer as fast as possible. You can shout if you want. Okay? So, a tennis racket and a ball cost $11 in total. The racket costs €10 more than the ball. How much does the ball cost? So, 50% of Princeton students said $1. But think about it, that's not the correct answer. It can be $1, but it's not necessarily $1. It can be 50 cents, and the racket can be $10.50. The idea of this is just to illustrate that we satisfy, that we're happy with an answer that seems plausible, and then we accept it, and we don't really think further about it. And Eric Ries yesterday gave a similar example where he mentioned the Amazon case where he had this book that cost $39. Then you seem to have a package which was $117, which was actually just 3 times $39. But we think that it's a discount, but it's actually not. We take a look at it and we see it like, okay, that could be plausible, but you don't really think about it further. This is a second test. I'm not going to do it here because I don't think we have the time, but here the test is memory. So you have a number of words. You can try it at home with a friend. Like you have these words and you ask to remember these words. To look at the words, don't write them down, and you make them disappear. And then you ask your friend to write down as many words as he can remember. Okay, now The thing is that it's not really important the amount of words you can remember, but to see if the word sleep appears in the list. Chances are high that that word will appear in the list, even though it was not in this list. That's actually to illustrate that if a memory doesn't work correctly, it's not always because we forget something or we're not able to remember something, but also because we create false memories. This is fundamentally linked to how the memory works. A memory doesn't work like a filing cabinet or like a hard drive, because when we encode memories, it's part of a bigger network. For example, if you take the priming test, I don't know if you know it, if you ask someone to say white 5 times, and then you ask, what does a cow drink? Chances are high they will say milk, which is not true. That's because milk is actually encoded into your memory with a network of associations. Like you could have milk, cow, grass, something like that. That's how you actually remember milk. So when you get this priming, those other associations you make, they come to the surface and they will pop up more easily. So that's the whole basic thing of priming. And also it illustrates how the memory actually works. Now you can get very strange effects this way. There's this case about a person who feels paralyzed in his legs, so he can't walk because a truck drove over his legs. Now the strange thing is that that never really happened, but he remembers that event and that makes his legs feel paralyzed, which is actually an illustration which makes me think of the movie Inception, which means that in theory it is possible that your mind can get infected with an idea which can then actually influence your behavior afterwards. Another example is plagiarism. This is Mark Twain. It's not Albert Einstein, as a lot of people think. Which means that you can get source confusion. Which that means is, for example, if you have a brainstorming session and a lot of ideas get thrown around, and then afterwards you think about those ideas again and again, and then it could happen that an idea that was actually from someone else, you get the idea that it was your own idea, and you destroy the connections with that other person, and you become so convinced that it's actually your own idea, which is again an example of a false memory. And it actually happened to Mark Twain, where he actually wrote this part, and he was so convinced this was his own part, but then afterwards it was found out that it was someone else's part, and he actually apologized. But just to illustrate that the memory is not perfect. There's also an important part, which is the text and the context, which refers back to, for example, the milk, where you make the associations with white cow, grass, for example, is there's this integral link between these two. If you would be asked to remember these words, it would actually be quite difficult. But if you would be asked to remember these, which is actually the exact same succession of letters, it would be much easier, because you have this whole context around each word, which makes it a lot easier to remember these things. Now, applied to web design, I don't find a lot of examples, but this one is the best one I could find, which is basically if you have a website and you have different sections, is consistency really that good? Not always. What Wired does well is they have different sections, and each section, which is focused on a different topic, gets a little bit of a different treatment, which is actually better for memory. A not so good example is then the New York Times, which also has these different sections like politics, world, technology, but actually all those sections, they look similar, so they're not very memorable, except for one section, which is video, which is different, which actually makes it that you remember that section a little bit more, or a little bit better. A very good book if you want to know more about these kind of tricks. It's actually my favorite book, it's Mind Hacks. There's also a chapter about memory. Now, the third part is to show you some examples of how you can make something more memorable. Now, I want to say that I don't have the answers myself. I'm not a cognitive psychologist. I have a background in economics, but I'm most interested in behavioral economics, which actually some kind of way in between. But if you're interested in this, I started reading a lot about this as well. But the best resource that I found so far is this book by Chip and Dan Heath. It's called Made to Stick. And it actually talks about why some things are more memorable than other things. And they made this kind of checklist, which by coincidence spells success, which is kind of weird, but it's also deliberately done for memory purposes. It's a mnemonic itself. I will now go through each of these six to try to show you some examples of actually web design examples, if possible, to show you how you can apply these six rules. So the idea is that you apply each of them to try to make something more memorable. First one is simple. To make it simple, of course, the example is Google. If you boil something down to the very core of what it is, it will be easier to remember. Quote from Leo Burnett, make it simple, make it memorable, make it inviting to look at, make it fun to read. This is a very nice example. You probably notice it's Umbrella Today, where you just enter a postal code and says if you have to use your umbrella that day, yes or no. That's the only thing it says, basically. Now, for me, I found this example in a presentation in 2008 by Christopher Fay. It was actually some kind of meta example for me of how it was memorable for me because it was actually so simple. Second part, something being very unexpected. Another quote. Now, the thing is that you should get people's attention first by doing something unexpected. This is actually an example from a bank called PNC. I think it's a Canadian bank, I'm not sure. And they have, sorry?
US bank.
It's a US bank? Okay. And they have this section called virtual wallet, which is actually totally different from anything you've seen before in the banking world, which is then something unexpected. Also, they have different features and they highlight and they promote them in a very unexpected way, which grabs your attention and actually makes it more memorable. Another example, I don't think they're present here, it's called Suit Supply. They're booming in Europe, which is actually a kind of store where you can buy suits, which seems like a very dull or kind of boring subject, but they do it in a very, very interesting way, totally different from anything you've seen before. So a very special way of communicating. Another example is Benetton, which here focuses more on shock value. Actually, I give this example to give the contrast that you don't always have to go for shock value. You can also do the exact opposite, where you're so subtle that people like almost don't notice it. Probably you know what I want to highlight here, which is the arrow in the FedEx logo between the E and the X, which not a lot of people know, but if you know it, then you actually have to think, that's actually kind of smart, and you remember that. Another one, you know what I... Yeah, but what's hidden here? Like there's the bear inside the logo, right? Then another one, which is Carrefour, it's actually some kind of European Walmart. Actually, I've seen this logo for years, and I've walked past it, and I didn't notice it, but can you see what's special about it? There's actually a C inside a negative space. So for years, I thought this, I didn't notice it, and also when I tell this to my friends, a lot of them did, that's actually true, I never noticed that. Which can also be useful. You can say like, okay, but if nobody notices it, then what's the point? But if you do notice it, you get a feeling that this is kind of special, and you even want to tell that to other people. Some more examples of this are in this presentation by Paul Annett from ClearLeft, or I don't think it's still at ClearLeft, which kind of gives you all of these kind of Easter eggs in web design as well. Now, another reference to, I think it was my favorite presentations these last 3 days by Carl Collins, Interfaces Are Made of Words. Like in the introduction text, I say that if you think differently about what's the focus of UX design, that's actually memory, and that can actually influence even the smallest button. Like for him, what seems to have made an impression for him or what stuck to his memory was this labeling called, okay, looks good, if you want to send a message. instead of saying submit. So that seemed to be something that stuck to his memory, which is kind of an example of even the smallest details you can use. Third part, be concrete. Einstein, if I can't picture it, I can't understand it. And here an example is global rich list. Basically, what you do here is you enter your yearly salary, and on this kind of scale, it tells you, like, what your position is in the wealth of the world, basically. Also, it has this row of people at the bottom, which gives you the position, like, anyone in the Western world is always in the top 10%, basically. That's kind of the point. It very concretely illustrates the message, basically. Then another thing to keep in mind, and which is often forgotten, is most web designs, they're almost exclusively like text and some kind of visual, but it's important to keep in mind that we think in different ways, and some people think in different ways than other people. It could be visually and sound, kinesthetically, so by doing something, in abstract and in movement. And to make something memorable, keep in mind to mix these kind of modalities. The website has changed recently, but this is a UK copywriting company. And when you came on their homepage, you saw this. Which is actually an example of using movement to get this kind of rhythm to communicate this message. So not just saying bang, this, but actually having this kind of animation and movement. I'm happy to see that Connie also mentioned a lot of these things, also these kind of primal modalities. Another example, which you probably know.
Our educational institutions, our business practices, our governing institutions, etc. Let me take you back to the early 1990s. Sleepy little laboratory in Parma, Italy, and scientists had a MRI brain scanning machine on a macaque monkey as the macaque monkey was trying to open up a nut. They wanted to see how the neurons would light up. So the monkey's trying to open up the nut, the neurons light up, and just by serendipity, and this is how science sometimes happens, a human being walked into the laboratory. I don't know if it was by mistake.
I love this kind of example. This is also a really great example because it actually uses visual, it uses sound, it uses abstract, and it uses movement to communicate a message. So it mixes these different kind of modalities to communicate something. Another great book, as I have it right here, is actually Understanding Comics, which actually, it seems silly or childish, but it's actually extremely well researched. What's also fun is that the book itself is actually a comic, and it tells you a lot about how we think, how we see faces, things like that. Also things that Connie mentioned, like removing realism to make something more effective, to communicate something more effectively. Then the fourth part, credible, also an example used by Jared Spool. This is pretty basic, an example by 37 Signals. So using these different tools to make something more credible, basically like social proofing, again, showing the visuals, so how many people use this, giving the testimonials, etc. Then another important part is emotion, which actually Connie went into detail, great detail as well. Is emotion to color the experience, and more importantly, how the experience will be remembered, by Donald Norman. It not only colors how you remember something, but it also reinforces you to remember something. So you will remember something more easily if it has some kind of emotional effect. Another example.
Hello, and thanks for flying with Virgin America. A few announcements as we begin our flight. Everyone should have a look at the safety card that is in the seat pocket in front of you. Not only does it have pretty pictures, but it has important information about the location and how to operate all exits and explains other safety features of this airplane. Please keep your seatbelt fastened whenever the seatbelt light is on. To be safe, we recommend your seatbelt stays fastened whenever you're in your seat, just in case there is unexpected turbulence. And please comply with instructions from the in-flight team with regard to the fastened seatbelt signs. For the 0.0001% of you who have never operated a seatbelt before, it works like this. Just insert the metal end into the buckle until it clicks, and pull on the loose end to tighten. To open, lift on the top of the buckle. Be sure the seat belt fits low and tight across your lap, and you're good to go.
So I could have mentioned this in Unexpected as well, because it's kind of unexpected. But what's great about this is that the content itself you already know, and you're kind of inclined to ignore it because you've seen it so many times before. What they do here, it's unexpected. It's also a comic. It reduces realism as well, to, again, reference Connie. But it's also, it has this emotional effect, use this kind of humor to attract your attention and to impress the message. This is actually important because it's a safety message onto your memory. The presentation by Connie, it's actually, it mentioned a lot of things I mentioned today. Also, faces, which is an important part of her presentation as well. We are actually, by nature, we automatically see faces everywhere, even in the grills of cars, etc. So actually use that in your designs. Use this abstract. Even if it's two dots in a line, you automatically see a face in that. The final part, stories. Actually, again, the reference to a different presentation by Steven Anderson, which is actually totally about this subject, which was great, of course. We're talking about narrative imagining. What's important here is also, as Daniel Kahneman said, is that stories is actually the way we remember things. We tell ourselves stories. So keep these things in mind when designing something again. Changes, significant moments, and endings. And incorporate that into your design. I don't know if you know Tom's Shoes, which actually, when you buy a pair, you actually also give another pair to someone else in a developing country. Another example is the fountain pen example by Steven Anderson, where it was not just this pen. There was this whole story around the specific pen, which actually made you remember that better. And endings are extremely important. So even if you have a sales process and the whole experience is great, but then you screw up at the end, you're actually in trouble because the endings are so important. Now, you can ask the question, can you make things forgettable too? Because now we've always talked about how to make something memorable. Of course, you can make things forgettable too. It's done all the time, where you see this privacy statements, etc. They actually don't use the techniques that were just described. So that way, you can make something forgettable. Also, in some cases, you might want that. And this is where classic usability comes in. So the techniques mentioned previously can help you make something memorable, but other parts you might want to make forgettable. Like, if you have to fill in a form, okay, it's a hassle, but then use usability to make it unremarkable and to make it not special so that you actually don't remember anything of it. Also, keep in mind that we don't actually remember time spent, so actually the amount of time you spent on a form doesn't really matter, as long as it's unremarkable or not memorable. Meaning, basically, that you don't have any problems. Then a thought on testing. Can you do testing? Of course. Like, we usually do usability testing to see if the experience is great, but can you also test what people remember from the website? Of course. It's already done in marketing. You have recognition tests, recall tests, top of mind awareness tests. So you can actually also do that on websites. Also ask people what you remember from the website or from the experience. This was an email I got after I visited a talk by Seth Godin, or Godin. And it asks, can you evaluate things? Now, what's important to remember here is that you're not actually asking about the experience because it was sent afterwards. So, de facto, you actually ask about the memory. Now, is that bad? That's actually not bad because we make decisions based on the memory we had of that experience. Now, to wrap up, now, you can ask the question, can you actually design memories? Of course you can. You can never know what someone will remember, but you can tell the same thing for experiences. You can never design how someone will experience something. But you can use these techniques to try to make something more memorable and other parts more forgettable, basically. The big conclusion, like, when I made the title on why we should not focus on UX, I'm not saying that UX is not important, but it should not be the focus. Because we don't make decisions based on the experience. You make the decisions based on the memories. So UX is important, but it's not the goal, it's a tool. So what you should do is learn how we remember stuff. So learn this cognitive psychology, learn how the memory works, how to use those techniques, etc. So if you're convinced, I can recommend just watch the full video from Daniel Kahneman. It's called Experience Versus Memory. You can also read Made to Stick, and I can also highly recommend Mind Hacks. Now, final word on audiobooks. Mind Hacks, you can also buy that in audiobook, which is good because it also helps you remember the content of the book. Now, that's because when you remember something, you also remember the context. So I can remember parts where I was. I can link that to the part of the book. It doesn't work with everybody, but it works very often. For those who attended the presentation about disruption, you remember that we were taken out of the room, and then we went into the hall, and then we went back into the room. Ask yourself the question, do you actually remember more about that talk because you were in different places? In some cases, you might. Also, when you attend a conference, a tip is to move places between presentations. So don't always sit in the same spot, because you take in the context together with the message. And if you're always at the same space, it's like a sponge. Once it gets saturated, and it won't make any more links. So again, it's this thing with the Velcro where you have text and context. So change the context, it will help you actually to remember things. Just one final test. We're almost done. What I'd like you to do here is to close your eyes. I'm going to let you listen to a piece of music, and then let's see what happens.
I'm a new soul. I came to this strange world hoping I could learn a bit about how to give and take. Strange world, hoping I could learn a bit about what is true and fake. La 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 la.
Any specific memories popping up? Yes. It was a commercial for the MacBook Air. So a lot of people get, maybe this was too old, so maybe the experiment failed. But basically, what I want to show you here is that sound is a very powerful, actually it's a memory cue. It can be fabricated or it can be personal. Like sometimes in movies or in commercials, they use a soundtrack, and then actually you get that very strong link with the subject. So afterwards, if the real single is released, then you actually have to think about the product. And everyone has that, that you have this kind of song, and it makes you think of this kind of moment in your life. So actually, you have another very powerful cue, less practical for us in web design, is odor. For example, cinnamon makes me think of pineapple. Other people have to think about apples or cappuccinos, for example, or perfumes. It's a very powerful, actually, cue. So again, conclusion, learn how we remember stuff. And the essence, in one line, with movement. So actually, when you design, the experiences should be in function of the memories you would want to create. Voila.
Thanks for listening to this podcast from the 2011 IA Summit. For more great user experience design content, visit UIE.com and sign up for our free newsletter, UIE Tips.